Macro Voices is pleased to bring you this encore presentation of an interview which originally aired in full color video on Real Vision Television at an earlier date. Real Vision is a paid subscription video on demand channel for finance. In partnership with Real Vision Television, we are pleased to offer Macro Voices subscribers a free trial subscription to Real Vision. To sign up, go to realvisiontv.com/discount/macrovoices. Macro Voices does not receive any commission or other compensation if you purchase a Real Vision subscription. We are proud to promote Real Vision because we believe they are the only other financial media outlet that shares our values and standards in financial journalism.
This is Aaron Chen of Macro Voices. For this week's Real Vision Television Encore presentation, we are thrilled to share an interview, which was originally published on July 20th, 2016, between Grant Williams of Real Vision and Michael Lewitt, founder of the Credit Strategy Group and writer of The Credit Strategist, a popular and acclaimed investment newsletter. In this interview, Michael's incisive analysis on the global economic and financial landscape is woven together with a rare combination of objective sobriety and humor. Aside from calling out the excesses and zombie companies lurking in the system, Michael doesn't pull any punches and openly questions the usefulness of the disinformation-spreading, ego-building, mainstream financial media edifice that deals in financial pornography. For those of you with a political itch to scratch, Michael also dives into his thoughts on what he calls a freak show election. Thanks again for listening, and don't forget to take advantage of an exclusive 10% discount on RVTV subscriptions by signing up at realvisiontv.com/discount/macrovoices.
After a slight delay, Michael, good to see you again.
Good to see you.
We had an aborted attempt to have a chat a few months ago, so I'm delighted that we can make this work.
Me too.
So much to talk about in the credit markets. I really don't know where to start, so I'm going to make you do the heavy lifting.
Sure.
What are you looking at right now? What's really flashing red on your radars right now in the credit markets?
Well, look, the markets, they sold off very sharply at the beginning of the year. They then rallied back. I'm sort of stunned to see that the average yield on the Barclays High Yield Index is like 7.5%. To be honest, I'm not sure if the companies that go bankrupt drop out of the index, but there have been 70 oil and gas bankruptcies so far, and in the last month or so, we've had some of the big ones fall: Sandridge, Lynn, a few others. Big ones, multi-billion-dollar companies. It was mostly smaller ones before then. And so, you're seeing the system do what it needs to do, which is purge this bad debt. But there's still an enormous amount of what I call zombie companies out there. If you look at like the retail sector, there's a bunch of these mall-based stores owned by private equity firms, J. Crew, Claire's, Gymboree, and a bunch of them, whose bonds are trading at 20, 30, 40 cents on the dollar. Their cost of capital is very high. So if they had to refinance, they couldn't. But they can pay their interest for now, and so they haven't defaulted. And they will default unless something changes radically, which I don't think it will, when their maturity dates come up. But in the meantime, the private equity firms can keep collecting their fees, and they just go along. But you have sort of this this zombie army of companies in retail that is waiting to go bust. And the whole retail industry, when you look at Sears, you look at others, Sports Authority filed for bankruptcy, Aeropostale, I think, just did. You have that whole sector that's going through enormous changes and is very credit challenged. And just in general, in the whole corporate area, you have companies that are not generating a lot of free cash flow. Corporate debt is much higher than it was in 2007 and 8. Andrew Lapthorne at Société Générale does great work on this. Recently, Moody's and S&P put out data on this. Corporate America is much more leveraged than it was in the non-financial sector. The banks have obviously delevered. And these companies are not generating anywhere near anything meaningful in terms of free cash flow. So the only thing that's saving them is low interest rates. And that's, when it comes time to refinance, some of them will be able to, but the ones that are where the bonds are trading at distressed levels, they're going to go bust. And the question for me is, you know, if you're a private equity firm and you issued bonds at par and the bonds are now trading at 25 cents, why aren't you buying those bonds back?
Yeah.
I think it's because you don't believe anymore in the business, especially in like these retailers where you're challenged by Amazon and by all these other problems, low wage growth and so on. So I think what you're going to see is you're going to see the default rate increase significantly, and you're going to see a lot of these companies close up. And that leads to other things. It leads to whether there are going to be problems with malls, with mall REITs, what's going to happen to all the space. You have the Sears situation. Sears is just a slow motion train wreck. There are still some true believers who believe that the real estate will bail out the situation. All I know is I look at a company that was buying back stock at $180, $190 a share a few years ago. The stock is actually up today because they had better than expected losses or lower than expected losses. So stock's up to like $13. But they've announced, I don't know, another 70 store closing. Same store sales are still declining. And they have a lot of real estate that they have to find a use for because it's not for, their highest and best use is not selling. Yeah. Selling stuff. So you have Sears, you have Kmart, you have a lot of problems. You have a lot of that whole sector. And but it goes beyond that. And so I just think the corporate debt sector is, you know, going to continue to underperform. I tell people, you know, you do not want to be in high yield. The risk-adjusted returns are very poor. Historically, you only want to be in high yield about 20% of the time. And that's, you know, when spreads are blown out like the 2,500 basis points in 2009. The rest of the time, your risk-adjusted returns are not worth it. And you're basically, you're just, you know, you sit there, if you run a big portfolio like I used to do, you sit there and you worry about what, you know, what this management team's doing, what that management team. Occasionally you run into a situation like Caesars, where you have a private equity firm like Apollo, who is just going to, you know, try to destroy the creditors. You know, it's not a very productive activity, and it doesn't generate the kind of risk-adjusted returns that are good.
So, you said risk-adjusted returns.
Yes, no one talks like that anymore.
Exactly, which is my point. You don't ever, you know, as we move further and further into la la land with interest rates going negative. The only way people can now justify, okay, let's leave risk-adjusted out of this. Let's just talk about the returns.
Well, I've been talking about this. You know, Stan Druckenmiller made important news a couple of weeks ago when he said, sell your stocks. And he didn't say buy gold. He said gold was his largest currency position, which I totally get. Yeah. Gold's a currency. But he said something much more important. He said that when he started Duquesne Capital Management in 1981, the riskless rate was 15%.
Yeah.
Well, today the riskless rate is zero. In Europe and Japan, it's below zero. And that says it all. It's very hard to generate even nominal returns of the mid-single digits in fixed income. It's virtually impossible.
Yeah.
So if you have to take risk, then you have to adjust your returns for, you know, risk adjust them. If you look at the largest bond funds in the world, the Vanguard Fund and the PIMCO Fund, and Vanguard's moved beyond PIMCO in terms of size, over the last 3 years, their returns are in like the one, you know, like 2%. Yeah. That's nominal. You then need to adjust them for inflation. So let's use the Fed's inflation, which I think is total nonsense.
Well, seeing as we are in la la land.
We're in la la land. So they're a zero. If you adjust it for real inflation, they're negative. And then if you adjust it for what I call the real inflation, which is currency debauchment, you're in the, you know, at least in the mid, negative mid single digits. But let's look further at how these funds are generating their returns. They're using derivatives and leverage. So by the time you're done, on a risk-adjusted basis, these are toxic products that are triumphs of marketing over anything else, and nobody should be in them. And of course, the PIMCO Total Return Fund, which started having lousy returns before Bill Gross left, and look, he was managing an ungodly amount of money. So I don't mean to be critical of him. He still has some of the most incisive things to say about the markets and about the Fed of anybody. But the fact was the returns were poor before he left for a couple of years. These products, they're just terrible. And if you just look at what's available in fixed income, you know, the Fed and the other central banks have destroyed fixed income as an asset class. And that's just, you know, that's just not a policy error. That's really a moral failing, because we have, you know, I live in Florida, so there are a lot of, you know, elderly people who are supposed to live on their savings. There are no savings.
Yeah.
And so what happens? So they go into their wealth manager and he can't offer them any bond alternatives to generate any income. So that, where do they go? They go into, you know, they're going to go into junk bonds. Well, that's not going to work out so well. They're going to go into MLPs. That's been a catastrophe, not only substantively, but in terms of the formal structural characteristics of MLPs. They get phantom income. I mean, it's a catastrophe. You know, Ben Bernanke thought it would be a great idea to tell people to take risk. Well, there's only one problem. Ben Bernanke never took any risk as an investor in his life. He's a professor. He's never sat behind a desk and taken risk and lost money. And until you've done that, you don't know what it involves. So, you know, the people making policy, it's all theory. And the problem is economics doesn't work in theory. It works in practice. And this is what we have. So we have a world with, you know, negative rates, half the bonds in the world trade at negative rates, sovereign bonds, whatever the percentage is, and there's no way to earn a decent return. And I talk about risk-adjusted returns all the time, because you have to understand what risk you're taking, because we see all too often people make a whatever the nominal return is for a few years, and then they lose it all overnight. I mean, hedge funds are a case study in that. You know, a guy does, you know, he's up 40%, and then all of a sudden it vaporizes, and he loses it all and more, because the risks he took in terms of concentration and other risks to get that return are not recognized, and investors don't recognize it. Even so-called sophisticated, large investors don't recognize that. And that's where we are. It's a very dangerous environment to be in.
But you do have to sit there. Like, how do you deal with this? Because you do have to sit there and you do have to commit capital.
Yes.
And you do have to invest money. So how are you handling this?
Well, the fund I manage is an options fund that the whole strategy is based on generating risk-adjusted returns. We sell straddles on the S&P 500 on a 3-month rolling basis, and then we at the money, and then we hedge them. So everything we do is based on generating a risk-adjusted return on a hedged basis. I no longer really actively manage much credit money, a little bit. And when I do, I mean, there's honestly only like a handful of bonds I think are right, worth the risk on a risk-adjusted basis. What's unusual about our fund is that we're generating very high single-digit returns in a fund that's over, I'm embarrassed to say, it's probably 70% in cash right now.
Right.
And the reason for that is because I could invest some of the collateral, but I'm not going to buy junk bonds. I just don't see anything that's going to generate as high a return as my options. So we just follow the strategy. This is a strategy that was developed 20 years ago by my co-manager, and what caught my eye when he asked me to join him was it was flat in 2008.
Right.
Now what's nice about it is because we sell these on a 3-month rolling basis. If we have a bad month, like last August, we were down 3%, the market was down 6%, we usually capture at most maybe 40-50% of the downside. When the bad month rolls off, and that's when it's, you know, it rolls off on the expiration date,
yeah,
that's when it's time to sell the next straddle. If it's a bad month, it means option premiums have obviously widened.
Sure.
So you're collecting a bigger premium, which sets you up to basically recover that loss in the following month. So if you look at the history of the fund, our worst months are always followed by our best months. So I tell people, sort of a little bit tongue-in-cheek, there are no Valiant Pharmaceuticals in our fund.
Right.
First of all, there's no single stock risk. So more importantly, you can't get caught in a death spiral.
Right.
Whenever you lose money, it's going to snap back because of the structure of the strategy. Is it coincides with the opportunity to recapture the loss by selling straddles and collecting a bigger premium. And that's very nice. So like at the end of 2008, had a couple down months, and then recaptured them 2009. Last August, we were down 3. By the end of the year, we had more than recaptured. We were up 8.25. For me, it's having done managed credit for many, many years, it's very nice to be able to manage a fund that it doesn't matter if the market's going up or down. The fact that we're selling straddles does not mean we're short. We're short biased.
Yep.
We're completely market neutral, and we're hedged on the first 2 months and the two most closest months all the time. We leave the third month. We don't need to hedge that right away, and we adjust the straddle. So, for example, we adjust the hedges. So, if the market moves up, we'll raise the puts on the bottom. If the market goes down, we'll lower the calls. And what we're trying to do is sort of tighten the profit range, and then we'll close it out when we think it's optimal. And it works very well, and it works consistently. Like in January, it's interesting, January was a horrible month, and the market and the S&P ended up down like 5 and something. We were actually up 25 basis points, which even I was impressed with. Right. I'm not impressed with anything, because it really showed that the strategy really works. But part of it is we learned after August, we just adjusted the hedges a little bit more to protect on the downside. And it worked.
When you talk about being 70% in cash, this is very, very interesting to me, because you talk about kind of half joking and it's embarrassing. This kind of stigma attached to being in cash. I get it at the certain points in the cycle, but right now when I hear guys like John Burbank talking about how he's raising his cash allocation to the biggest he's been in X amount of years. There's nothing wrong with being in cash. The hard part is trying to get the buy-in of your stakeholders that it's the right thing to do.
We talk to a lot of people, and options, you have to really, not everybody gets them. I got one comment that I thought was, incredibly stupid.
And, just one?
Well, one that I'll talk about. And you know me, I don't hold back. But somebody said, well, we can't invest in this because institutions like to manage their own cash. And I said, okay, clearly this person has no understanding of what we just said. I mean, it's like, it reminds me of the time, and I won't say who it was, when somebody told me in 1996 or 7 that they weren't going to invest in our high yield fund because we didn't use mathematical models like long-term capital management. And it's like, okay, so you do this long enough, you hear pretty much everything. But no, look, the thing about our strategy, you have to be extremely disciplined.
Yeah.
The market's moving up, we're still buying protections on the downside. Market's moving down, we're still buying protections on the upside. And I've seen where the market has turned around and it's helped us. It doesn't matter. If you just follow the discipline, not try to be a wise guy, not try to you figured this out. You developed this system. If you don't try to beat your own system, you'll do well. Now, about 75% of this is what I call systematic. The 25% that's not is, adjusting the hedges. And then also, when do you close out? Because we talk and we say, okay, we have, let's say, we only do 3 contracts per million, so we're not ever leveraged, obviously. And so we'll say, okay, we have a $4,000 per contract profit. If the way our hedges are designed, the most we can lose from here is we'd end up with a $3,000 profit, but our maximum upside is, say, $7,000. That would be a big profit. What do we want to do? We'll decide, and we'll use our judgment. That's not
right.
That's not systematic. That's where our judgment enters in. But when we sell the straddles, when we sell subsequent straddles, the initial hedges, those are all, rules based. But it's a very different kind of investing, and for me, it's very interesting because having, sort of done, credit for so long. I mean, at times we'll buy, we, in the past, 2013, we owned some event-driven junk bonds that helped us because if volatility is too low, the premiums are low, and it's not that we lose money, we just don't make as much.
Yeah.
But right now, I don't see anything I want to own that can, because we sort of have a 10% hurdle rate on our options, and I don't see anything that comes close to that, so I don't have to worry about it. And that's good because, I follow the junk bond market closely, I follow a lot of names, but it's really, the market has changed, It's not liquid. Even for small amounts, it's not liquid. So it's like, you know, I really don't know. You know, these big credit funds, I mean, there's only the only exit for them is a refinancing or a maturity. So they really have to hedge with derivatives to protect themselves from the downside. And again, on a risk-adjusted basis, I just don't think the returns are all that attractive. Never mind nominally, they're not really churning out good numbers. And to be able to generate, you know, high single-digit returns, you know, the fund has an eight-year tracker, audited track record, including 2008, of about little under 8%, and the last 3 years has done under 9%. You know, I'm very, you know, satisfied with that. And, you know, we're just, you know, the fund was very small when I took it over. They asked me to build it up, which we're doing. And you know, I thought it was something, it's scalable, it's liquid, I'm trading a liquid instrument. It's the opposite of the high yield market, which is like going into that wall and just banging my head against it. It's constantly.
You're running the Chicago Bulls triangle offense, it seems to me. You just trust the system.
Trust the system. And, you know, the guy who developed the options and does them day to day is a remarkably talented guy. And also disciplined. He's the kind of guy you want, you know, when you look for a profile, that's what you want. So it
are you done with credit? Do you see yourself, because I talk to people who, my old boss, Steve Diggle, was a vol guy.
Sure.
He's out the vol business because he just doesn't see his business. But that doesn't mean he won't get back into it. Do you see a point in time where you'll go back in when this clears and there's a recognizable market again, or do you think those days are done?
Well, you know, I write something called the Credit Strategy Association.
You do. It's a fantastic thing to read.
Thank you. Look, the issue with being in the credit business, if you really want to have a credit fund, you have to have a big staff and all that. I don't see necessarily doing that, but I am working with, you know, institutional investors in the Mideast who may end up having a need for credit, and I'll work with them. But I don't, you know, I see the immediate future as building this into a substantial fund, and that's more than enough. But the credit markets, look, they're so important in terms of what's going on in macro that I'll never, you know, I'm always, you know, I read the research, I follow the companies, I write about a lot of them. I wrote a lot in last year about Valiant, for example. You really need I like to look both from the top down and the bottom up. And it's very important to look, for example, and you read all these, you know, financials, and you see that, hey, these companies aren't generating any cash flow. You know, what does that say about the economy? And I think you need to get that kind of granular information from looking at what these companies are doing. When I dug into Valiant and, you know, started looking, and I didn't look, I have to admit, I didn't look when it was 260 a share, but I looked when it, you know, got to about 200. And then when I really dug into this balance sheet, and you know, I said, you know, there's something, you know, what are people looking at to think that this thing's worth all this money? And you know, and the more you dug, this was like one of these things where it's like a rotten apple. You just kept on, you know, the deeper you got, the more rotten it got. But you need to look both micro and macro to really understand what's going on. Because Valiant told a really interesting story about the pharmaceutical industry, about drug pricing, told an interesting story about Wall Street, told an interesting story about hedge funds. It was so thematic and so about activism, about all this stuff. And it wasn't a good story either.
No.
But it was an important story because it really pointed to things that were wrong that were overlooked by a lot of ostensibly smart people. And that's how you learn. I mean, you have to look at the particular and the general, and credit is where a lot of things start. I mean, the credit markets clearly, you know, tend to lead the equity market, and you know, the high yield market, which is, you know, those are hybrid securities. You just have to be aware of what's going on. But I don't know if I don't have any particular desire to manage a credit fund or anything again. I mean, especially with the lack of liquidity.
Well, yeah,
it's just so frustrating. I mean, look, if you're in a stock, you can generally get out of it if you make a mistake. I was talking to somebody recently. I mean, one of the most important attributes of a good investor is cut your losses. I mean, what I don't understand is, you know, look, hedge funds, you know, these, you know, really smart guys, look, everybody loses money. If you don't lose money, you're not a real investor. But what I don't understand is I don't think guys, you stop losses anymore. So I mean, how do you, you know, these drawdowns are unacceptable and they're too large and they don't have to happen. I mean, first of all, people are, you know, they're violating basic rules about concentration limits.
Yeah.
And then they're violating rules about stop losses. I mean, this is not some macho game where you're supposed to like, oh, I'm a hedge fund manager, I got to average down, you know. I mean, well, it's one thing if you're average down if you have a 1% or 2% position. But you already have 10% of your fund or 15% of your fund, and the thing is down huge. It's time to cut your losses or hedge them or something. And I don't see that being done. And I don't understand why that's acceptable to investors. I really don't.
No, I agree with you. But investors have basically, there's this cult of celebrity, even in hedge fund managers.
Yes.
People somehow feel privileged to be in certain funds because they can't get in. Then there's the hubris that goes with Wall Street. And look, that's not always an exclusively a bad thing. Sometimes you need a little bit of that in this industry.
You need ego.
Yeah.
But there's a line where ego crosses over to hubris.
Yeah, look, that's a better way of
putting
it.
Look, I won't name names, but there are people who have had problems that was obvious to me. And look, I'm the most self-critical person I know. So and if I don't do the job, my wife does it for me. So believe me.
Good to have backup.
Believe me. There's no. So I get it. Okay. But I see guys who are clearly, they're going to blow up, because you see they, you know, look, there's a big difference between intellect and emotional intelligence. Okay. It's something that we all wrestle with. It's very difficult. And it's so disappointing because you're truly brilliant people who just like they can't stop themselves. And it's frustrating because it's a shame. But when you look for a manager, you really have to, you know, character is number one. I mean, if you're not smart, you're not talking to them to start with. Character is very closely tied to emotional intelligence and the ability to listen to other people and all these other things. And you can see it. I mean, you can see it. And now we have this thing where, you know, with celebrity managers or with people who feel that they have to announce to the world what they're doing. I don't understand. I mean, my view is if you're a manager, you're supposed to be at your desk or, you know, working, doing research, talking, you know, making the calls and so on. If you're parading yourself around on television all the time, to me that just takes away from the time you have to work. There are only so many hours, number one, and number two, there it seems to be you're sort of seeking this public adulation that to me is completely contrary to helping you do your job.
Yeah.
I mean, the more people that are blowing smoke up your behind about how wonderful and brilliant you are. You are the closer to disaster every minute. And it's like, you know, thank God, you know, I adore my wife. I worship her. I rarely, you know, compliments are not the basis of our relationship. She's the one who tells me, you know, you're a schmuck, don't do this, don't do that. You need that because you need somebody to really keep you grounded. And, you know, the way I always do it, you know, and I've always done it, you know, I'm always scared to death about what's the next disaster. I'm not worried about, you know, it's like when people come up and say, oh, I like this, thank you, okay? I never hear that. I hear what I did wrong, what I missed, this and that, because it's you know, I've lost money, fortunately not as much as I've made money, but you lose money and it's terrifying. It's a horrible feeling. And it's like, you have to really be aware of just what, you know, when you're managing money for people, that's a huge responsibility. And you have to respect the fact that this money's important to people and they've trusted you. And you're violating that trust. Look, you can lose money sort of in a way that is, you know, has integrity, but you could also lose money in a way that doesn't have integrity. And you just have to really stay grounded. And you know, I have stopped watching any of the financial television. I just don't do it. I don't turn it on. I don't watch it because I find it to be a very noxious force. It's first of all, there's very little, you know, occasionally, you know, somebody was worthwhile I'll be on, but I just don't watch it because there's nothing useful. There's rarely any information on it.
Yeah.
And it's all about, it seems like it's all about people going on to like, get their egos built up. What's that about? You're supposed to be doing your work and learning. What are you learning about being on TV and telling, oh, you know, I think China's going to fail. I mean, it's not helpful. I mean, there are only so many hours in a day. There's too much to know. There's too much noise. You got to focus. You got to rule out what you don't need, and you got to really stay disciplined. And all this other stuff is just crap.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what I observe, and it's gotten worse. I mean, it's just gotten, look, we're at a conference here, okay? But you know, there are all these conferences, and some of them are televised, and all this stuff. And they're used, and the conferences like make news. So the conference makes news, then they report on the news. It's like the world is like one big Fox political porn exhibition, and it's like, and so we have, you know, we have financial porn, and it's like, it's not real, and that's the problem. You have to focus on what's real. And the more you have to fight through all stuff that's not real, the more energy it takes, the more focus it takes away, and that's really hard. So, you know, look, I live in Florida, I don't live in New York. I work in my home, I'm not distracted, and I like it though. In some institutions, you know, you don't have an office. I don't have an office. So I don't have a bunch of people running around interrupting me and bothering me. In my old office, I used to have a red light I put on to keep people out of it. And they all thought I was nuts. But you know, if you want to read, if you want to write, you need focus. You need to be uninterrupted, and you really do. You know this. I mean, you can't. You can't be bothered with stuff. You have to set time apart. So I just read an interesting article about Ray Dalio, who said the secret to his success is he meditates twice a day for 20 minutes. And I like totally get that. Because if you don't set time apart to think and to focus, I go to the gym twice a day. And I actually, in the morning, I read the Wall Street Journal intensely. And at night, I usually read something else. But I need to be, I'm so hyper, so I need it for the physical exercise. But I need it to just sort of flush the system and focus. And you know, there's so many distractions. And so one of the distractions I decided to remove was no more financial television, because I'm done. I just can't, and you know, I can't do it. It doesn't add anything to my knowledge base. I'm sorry. I mean, that may sound arrogant, but that's how it is.
Real Vision accepted, of course.
No, Real Vision, but that's what's great about Real Vision. And about, like, I listen to podcasts sometimes. Like, I listen to Joe Rogan's podcast. There's all kinds of crazy shit on that. But the fact is, you can have an extended conversation with somebody. You know, they put you on fire. And I've done this. I've done, you know, all these shows.
I've seen you.
So it's like, you know, answer this question in 13.5 seconds. It's like, you know, come on. I mean, and I think more and more people, that's why Real Vision is so successful and so valuable, because people want to actually hear somebody think. And it's like, a lot of times they ask you a question, you don't know when you start the answer where you're going to end up, and it's sort of a skill, but it's not really useful. I mean, occasionally, like if there's somebody unusual, like if Nassim Taleb is going to be on, I'll watch, or if Lee Cooperman's on, you know, he's a friend, I'll watch, and it's interesting. But I really just don't watch it, and I'm much calmer, I'm much happier, I'm not agitated. Of course, all my buddies send me emails, like Doug Cass and Peter Fugard say, oh, you see what this guy said? Tom Lee's back on, you know. The market's going to 4,000. You know, I get all those emails.
Right.
But, you know, we joke about it. But it's, look, most of the stuff is noise. It's redundant. You need to focus on stuff. I also try to get information from non-traditional sources, because we know what the consensus is thinking. We get that. You need to test it, and you need to really look at, you know, just non-traditional offbeat stuff. And I find that, you know, sort of helpful. And also, you know, when you're writing, you know, write a newsletter, you want to keep it interesting, so I don't need to repeat what everybody else is writing. You want to bring a different viewpoint, and you want to sort of test the consensus and everything else. And also, part of the job is to, you know, I think to help people make money, of course,
yeah,
and to help them not lose money. So you got to get your information, you know, where it's useful. And, you know, right now, you know, fewer people read the newspaper because, you know, you can get news, or what purports to be news, you know, the same news in six different places. The really valuable stuff is, you know, the useful commentary from people who have informed, interesting, creative views, and that you have to search out and find and so on. I mean, it's not an accent that the Wall Street Journal gets thinner and thinner and thinner. I open it to the end, And, you know, the investing section, there's like nothing. It's like four pages. There's nothing in it anymore. I mean, it's horrible. But I open, you know, I go to the, you know, I read the editorial and all that stuff because that's where there may be something interesting. It's sad. I mean, it's just sad.
Well, wait, I mean, do you see, just getting back to markets, is there anywhere you see value? Because I'm struggling to find what I perceive as, not relative value.
I'm
thinking about this a lot because right now it's all about relative value. Is there any real value?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's relative value because there's no value.
Right,
Well, look, in fixed income, no. I mean, look, I'm not a mortgage guy, so there may be some value in mortgages. But I'm not qualified to really say. I think that if you're going to find value, it's most likely to be in non-public markets, in discrete transactions. I think you're going to see a large wave of distressed assets spill out in the market, obviously in energy, in commodities, in other areas, and I think there probably will be some value there. But look, there's an awful lot of money going to chase that, so I don't think it's going to, it may not hit kind of the levels you'd like, but I think there will be some. It's probably too early for a lot of the commodities and energy stuff, but I think you're going to have to look in private markets. I don't think anything's cheap. I think in a world where money is free, it's impossible for anything that is denominated in money to really be all that attractive. And that's the problem. And everybody's chasing these returns. No one's, as we said, testing them in terms of being risk-adjusted, inflation-adjusted, currency-adjusted. And that's a big problem. Look, I think the big story is going to continue to be over the next, decades, how we work off the debt. Well, we're not going to grow fast enough to generate enough income to pay it off. So that's not going to happen. You're going to have a lot of defaults. Puerto Rico is just a precursor of a lot of other government entities that are going to fail. So you have a lot of defaults. So a lot of debt's going to be written off. A lot of losses. And then you're going to have the two big stories, which I think are going to be inflation and currency devaluation, which are, they're two sides of the same coin, but they're not exactly the same, but they're closely related. And that's going to be a big deal. And I think the dollar will still be stronger than the other paper currencies for the most part. But I think gold will do well against all of them. And currencies are going to drive an awful lot of what happens, maybe everything, because when you get to the zero bound, you can't use interest rates anymore, you'll start, you use currencies, and that's what you're seeing.
Yeah, but that has knock-on effects with reserves, which...
With everything. But this is, the problem is, and then you have negative rates. I mean, this is all bad. There's none of this is pro-growth. None of this is pro-productivity. None of this is pro capital spending. This is all like this massive sort of four corners defense for the global economy, and it has an enormous cost. And there are solutions. Not that they could solve everything overnight, but in the U.S., you could have tax reform. You could have pro-growth fiscal policies. You could make things better, but we don't have so there are intellectual solutions, but we don't have the political will or the political wherewithal to solve it. And, that's roughly the same around the world. I mean, Europe has, huge structural problems with the EU. Japan has really huge, I think, cultural barriers to what's going on. China's sort of a special case. They have goals that are not... that are not purely economic. They're sort of what I call political economic to get to a certain place. But there are solutions. But the bottom line is right now the global economy is in like this massive sort of defensive stance, and it's very negative because it's growing so far below capacity. Debt is mounting up. It just it just keeps mounting and mounting. And debt has to be paid back or it has to be written off. It's a contract. So a lot of contracts are going to be broken. And it's a real problem that I don't think people are taking seriously enough. It's not like the world's going to end tomorrow. It's not like, China's not going to collapse tomorrow. They're going to manage it through, but there's this slow erosion of value. When you have negative rates, for example, that just eats away capital. I don't understand why there's not literally blood in the streets in these countries where you give the bank a dollar, you get back 99 cents or 99 and a half cents. I mean, that is a failure of government. It's a failure of policy, and it's really a moral failure. It's a government really stealing money from its people effectively. And people are like, you know, I mean, people, the problem is people have never seen it, so they don't really understand it. But that's what it is. And it's not only just, you know, it's not just bad policy, it's immoral policy, and it's really disturbing. And I don't understand the complacency about it. But there's no way you can grow with negative rates. It's like, it's so obvious. And you know, Mario Draghi is not an idiot. He knows what he's doing. So that makes him a very immoral person, in my view. And Kuroda, I don't know what. I mean, he talks about Peter Pan. I mean, the guy's delusional. They own 60% of the ETF market. I mean, Japan is in such a terminal situation demographically, economically, debt-wise. I mean, it's hard to, you know, what do you tell them? Plus, they sit on, I mean, this is a serious problem. They sit on an earthquake zone. They're like, the whole thing could, like, you know, really, this is, you know, people, you know, look at me like, you know, this is a serious problem. I mean, you know, it's a scary place. So I don't know what's going to happen there. But the good news is that, you know, the society has not fallen apart. You know, the way they are sort of culturally, they deal with this. But there was a great book called Bending Adversity. I forget the name. It's a great book about Japan that was written last year. I think it's called Bending Adversity. And it talks about culturally how the Japanese deal with, you know, like people say, oh my God, they're getting 50 basis points in their 10-year JGBs. This is horrible. No, that's not horrible. A tidal wave is horrible. A nuclear accident is horrible. A Hiroshima is horrible. 50 basis points on your JGBs are not horrible. And that seems to be, you know, the perspective. And so, like, after the, you know, after the terrible earthquake and the nuclear accident, you know, people were standing calmly in lines and everything. I mean, in this country, there'd be riots. You know, there are riots if the wrong person is killed in a city here. So it's like, this is a much more divided society. There, Japan, fortunately, they can keep things together. But just on a, you know, on a balance sheet basis, the country is, you know, beyond insolvent, and there's no way to solve it. So, you know, but buying ETFs and buying the stock market, I mean, you know, it's the second largest bond market in the world that doesn't trade.
Right.
I mean, they own, I think the government, central bank owns 35% of it. So this is nuts. But, so I wouldn't say that Kuroda is necessarily evil, but I really do think Draghi is doing something that's very, really bad, morally bad. And, you know, when they talk about, you know, gee, is Janet Yellen going to do negative rates? I don't think she will. But I also think that she and a whole bunch of them are just so detached from reality. I mean, when they're telling you there's no inflation, if you go to the supermarket, you buy health insurance, you buy health, I mean, come on. There's massive inflation, and if you just
look, and they do all of these things. They do go to the supermarket. They do buy health insurance.
Well, I said this yesterday, you know, at the conference. I said, you know, look, she's married to one of the foremost behavioral economists in the world, George Akerlof, who won a Nobel Prize, which I think may be the most overrated prize in the world. But he won it. God bless him. They must not talk, right? Because I mean, she thought low rates would lower, would get people to spend more. No, no, no. It gets them to save more. I mean, it gets, you know, are companies, you know, is there some CapEx boom? No. CapEx spending, David Rosenberg spoken very articulately about this, is way under. I mean, you know, we don't have capital deepening. It's a huge problem. I mean, our economy is not becoming more productive. I mean, Lacey Hunt points out that, you know, there was $800 billion of borrowing by corporations last year, and only 80 of it or 90 of it went into
capital spending
and R&D. I mean, this is a tragedy. And so, you know, you have activists getting guys to, you know, increase their dividends and M&A and stock buybacks. You know, it's one thing when Apple does a stock buyback, they have $200 billion of cash. They got, you know, that's fine. But all these other companies, you know, it's not productive. And look, there's probably not enough uses for all this cash, but the incentives for executives and the stock market and everything lean towards these unproductive uses. This is the problem. All our policies, and I've said this before, lead us to do the opposite of what we should be doing. Everything is upside down. We pay investment bankers much more than we pay teachers and doctors and so on. I mean, we pay the least productive people, you know, more than we pay more productive people. You know, it's just cockeyed, and so why should we be surprised that everything's so screwed up? I mean, we shouldn't, but that doesn't mean we should accept it. I mean, you have to try to educate and try to talk about it and try to move things. The problem is the system is so sort of locked in, and all the special interests are so locked in that it's just very hard to move. But I do think, look, I do think what's interesting about this election, other than the fact that it's a total freak show, is that I do think that if Donald Trump were elected, and I'm not saying whether I think that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I think there would be a greater chance of meaningful tax reform, because I do think that's something he would push for. And I do think that the tax code is the DNA of the economy, and it is the first step, if you could fix it, to getting us on a better path. A budget deal alone of any kind is not going to solve the problem. You have to change the tax code to end the, you know, you can't, you have to stop giving, treat debt better than equity. You got to, you know, you got to change all these incentives, because if you don't, we're just on this trajectory. And when, you know, I have this graph in my book that shows the path, debt growth versus GDP growth.
That's my favorite chart. And it's a chart in every presentation.
No, it's unbelievable.
It's the one chart everybody needs to understand.
It is, because it's like, I mean, this is simply not sustainable. You can't, last year, like Lacey Hunt pointed out, last year, debt grew at 3.5 times nominal GDP. But, you know, even an inflation-adjusted GDP was not that much worse. So 3.5 times. How is that possibly sustainable? We have low interest rates now, and we may have them for a long time, but it doesn't matter. This is just math.
Yeah.
This is just math. It cannot continue. At some point soon, the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, says by 2024, I think it'll be sooner, we're going to be paying $1 trillion a year just in interest on our debt.
Assuming it stays here.
Exactly.
Right.
So think about that. $1 trillion a year just on our debt. Now, we are paying a lot of that to ourselves, but that's a whole different discussion. This is not the way you run a railroad, because the railroad runs off the tracks. And it's just not good enough. It's just not good enough to say, well, that's the way it is, you can't change it, whatever. I mean, you know, Obama had an opportunity to address this, and said he decided to do Obamacare. And it's interesting, I just read this great book called Demosclerosis by Jonathan Rauch. Jonathan Rauch is somebody who everybody should go out and buy his books. They should buy Demosclerosis, and they should buy Kindly Inquisitors. Kindly Inquisitors is a book with, both were written in the 90s. He issued Kindly Inquisitors a couple years ago with George Will writing the foreword. And it's a book in which he promotes gay marriage, and George Will's writing the foreword, I note. But what's interesting is, it's not about that. It's about how, about liberal education and about what's going on in the colleges today, and how liberal education does not mean you get to be comfortable, you get to be coddled and all that. But Demosclerosis is a book about why our system's so frozen, and how every time there's a special interest program, once it's on the books, it's never getting off. Why? Because the special interest is so focused on keeping that, while everybody else is so sort of, you know, spread out, that they're not focused on getting rid of it. So, it, like, these things just stay. But unless we, you know, so Obama, you know, had this opportunity to do something with the economy, and instead he did Obamacare. Now, Obamacare, oh, and so in the book with Rauch, he talks about Clinton Care. Clinton said the same things that Obama said. You get to keep your doctor. Costs won't go up. All the same things. And then Rauch, who's not, I don't know what his political, I can't really tell what his political, he's
well, that's
of,
good.
But what's interesting, he says Clinton was totally detached from reality in all these promises. Well, look what happened with Obamacare. He made all these promises. He broke all of them. He imposed this on 1/6 of the U.S. economy. We see now, and you know, Nancy Pelosi said, not, and it's not just because it's an incredibly obnoxious, irresponsible comment, it's because it's true. We have to pass this bill to see what it says. I mean, this is almost treasonous, okay? So no one knew what was in it. The regional exchanges are failing. Healthcare, health insurance premiums are skyrocketing. You know, you can't get care, on and on and on. It's a disaster. It's a disaster. It has gotten more people on the rolls, but there was a much easier way to do this that wouldn't have cost as much. Of course, we're not seeing the cost yet because, of course, it doesn't kick in until after he leaves office. I mean, the problem is the narcissism and the self-delusion of our leaders is and the corruption is just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
And that's why you have a Donald Trump and a Bernie Sanders, because people are fed up. They don't quite know what to do with it. And you get people who are in many ways demagogues who can get traction because that's at least they're saying a lot of things that ring true. Then you have somebody like Hillary Clinton who says nothing that rings true, and yet sort of party stalwarts sort of cling to her. But this is the choice, because anybody else with a brain doesn't want any part of this in terms of running for office, because, you know, look at, you know, you have a toxic media that does this. So this is the problem. But we are on a very dangerous path. You cannot continue to have debt go like this, growth go like this, because this is ultimately what has to pay for this. And, you know, maybe rates will stay at one, you know, zero forever. But I'll tell you one thing, the high yield bond market didn't wait for Janet Yellen to raise rates. It raised rates all by itself. So the, what is it, $2.3 trillion of the bond market, the high yield bond market plus the bank loan market, just U.S., it's much larger worldwide. Well, those rates have been adjusted higher. So it ain't no 0%. You know, 7.5% yield right now on average on the Barclays Index. But like somebody told me yesterday, the CCC index last year was down 40%, including the coupon.
Yeah.
So those companies are all going to fail, okay? And a lot more of them. So the markets, you know, they're not waiting for Janet to get the courage to do the right thing and raise rates. And so you're going to have waves of defaults. Marty Fritzen, who's sort of the dean of high yield analysts, put out he gave a talk about a year ago. And he forecast in a normal default cycle, meaning 30% aggregate defaults over 2016 to 2019 cycle, there'll be $1.6 trillion of defaults because the market is $4.7 trillion globally. That's a lot of bad paper. Now, it's all not all going to zero, but that's if there's no recession, there's no crisis, et cetera, et cetera. And that's, you know, that's epic. That's a lot of bad paper that has to be absorbed by the system. And that's what we're dealing with. And that doesn't include Puerto Rico, Chicago, the state of Illinois, New Jersey, Philadelphia. California is going to end up, you know, having trouble. I'm leaving out a bunch. This is what we're dealing with. And then, you know, the U.S. government can keep printing money, you know, whatever. But, you know, this is what we're dealing with globally. And so it's something to worry about, because I don't see how stocks keep going up sort of obliviously while the credit markets are suffocating. And remember, a lot of these companies have stocks, and then you have the whole investment grade universe, which has more debt than it did before because they bought back stocks, you know, they bought back all their stocks and everything. So everything's more leveraged. So you just have a very unhealthy situation that is fed by bad policies that don't seem to be able to get changed. I think, you know, a lot of the guys who've done the best are guys who definitely understand policy. You know, guys who said, hey, you know, the Fed's going to bail this thing out. In 2009, they did very well for a while. If they stayed too long, because look, you know, stock market hasn't moved since October 2014 when QE ended. But if you know how to read the policy tea leaves, you can do very well. But you also have to understand that there's no end game here that's positive. The end game is like is one of the four scenarios I said, well, one of the three. We're not going to grow fast enough, so it's default, inflation, inflating away, or devaluing the currency away to pay back the debt. That's where you end up. I have to consult Spock and see if there's another dimension to see if there's something else you can do, but that's really it. I mean, you know, a lot of companies will do debt for equity exchanges and all this. All the energy companies, a lot of them are doing debt for equity exchanges. A lot of them did and then filed. They needed to do debt for equity exchanges much earlier. Like, I looked in July 2014, I looked at the Barclays High Yield Index, and I looked at the sub-indexes. So the average energy bond was 5%. And I said, oh, thank God I don't own any of these. They're not high-yield bonds at 5%. But this is what was going on. And, I mean, this was a total replay of 2000, you know, late 90s, when the telecom and internet companies built. I remember my former partner was at a conference. He called me. He goes, we got to sell all these telecom bonds we own and all these internet bonds, because I just heard some CEO go, we're not going to issue equity. We're just going to sell more bonds because the market will take it. And of course, you know, it was exactly the same thing. You know, it was based on, you know, they built enough fiber to go around the universe six times. It's the same thing. Look at Tesla's an interesting example. So Tesla just sold $1.4 billion of stock for itself and $600 million to pay Elon Musk paid, you know, sold stock to sell his taxes. I think they should have sold $5 billion of stock. There's like 120 million shares out, so it would have diluted them like 20%, whatever, because the stock's at $220 a share, which is ridiculous. They should sell it now, because if there are enough schmucks out there to want to buy that much stock, put them out of their misery, because that's going to be a $50 stock at most. The company is egregiously overpriced, and look, he's a great entrepreneur, God bless him, but the stock is ridiculous. And the lesson I've learned over and over and over again, sell equity, don't sell stock. You gotta pay the bonds back. Don't sell debt. You gotta pay the debt back. They should have sold literally five times the amount of stock. There's appetite for it because it's a cult stock. I mean, maybe it's unethical because you know it's going down, but that's what they should have done. But it's a classic. And also, they're a classic case because their financials are like, you know, nonsense, you know, with non-GAAP all this and non-GAAP that, and they're selling pollution credits and all this stuff. I mean, it's crazy. But it's like, you know, Valent was a snapshot of certain things. Tesla is a snapshot of certain things that we'll look back in a few years and say, hey, yeah, you're right, you know, whatever. I mean, there are certain companies that are sort of at the crossroads of all these trends that are really interesting. And
well, there's a lot of stuff going on that we're going to get the chance to watch play out, and we'll come back and discuss this again. But Michael, for now, thanks so much indeed.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.